Hi, I'm Stargate Pioneer.
And I'm Steven Jondrew, and we're from Better Podcasting, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of the individual host.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus. I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 193 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we learn that we've only got about 1,000 years left to enjoy these warm summer days. We learn that fashion is poised to take a seriously odd turn in a few centuries. Here's a tip, invest in plastic. And that through enough ice, anything can look like a Viking. I'm your host. My name is Keir, and joining me in the GPR studio, as is most weeks, is my co-host Haley. How you doing, Haley?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. Jay is out of the office today. He is not at SDCC, where, well, at least one of us ought to be. He is moving, preferably to better climes. So we'll see. We'll catch up with him next week.
Moving is so much fun.
Yeah, you did the moving thing. You're done with that. Yeah,
good times. Well, this week, we thought out a classic story that gave us one of the most interesting villains that we promptly shelved for decades. The Ice Warriors, in a story that is as much a cautionary tale of dependence upon technology as it is a battle with a militant alien species, the Second Doctor story was technically salvaged from among the lost episodes when the BBC sanctioned an animation team to recreate the second and third episodes.
For those intrepid folks that that choose to search these things out in the backwaters of the internet or some of the murkier spots of YouTube, you can find, in addition to segments of the loose canon that everybody knows about, some of the Telesnap recreations that were done, there was also a fan animation edit, which is the creepiest looking thing. It's kind of bug-eyed. One of these days, next time we see Frasier, we're going to have to make sure that we share some of the photos of how people animated him in what looks like MS Paint. It was just horrendous. But they were dark times, and we needed these episodes. And and having particularly the middle episodes, 2 and 3 out of a 6-parter, where really a lot of the important stuff gets laid out, you kind of want that stuff. So, but where to begin with this? This is... Yeah, as we mentioned in the intro, we're talking about a really interesting villain that we don't really get to see. I mean, we hear in some of the audios and some novels and things, but we don't get to see them again until the Cold War.
And that was going to be one of my questions. I was going to ask if they show up again, because I it's hard to believe they would just dig out a villain from, when was this, 1968?
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
Yep.
Just they randomly chose this one story villain to bring back to the modern show.
Yeah, it's just, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's, and when we do revisit them again, we're dealing with them in the same situation. I mean, it's, they're stuck in an ice block. Somebody decides for the sake of science and exploration, they're going to thaw them out. What could possibly go wrong? Then you've got them in a trapped environment with a limited number of individuals, and they're trying to break free. So it's, not to take anything away from Cold War, because it's a great episode. I absolutely love the Skaldak character and things like that. But going back to some of these individuals, So, well, as Haley mentioned, we've got a couple of Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm just going to make sure that I do say that we've got reference to them in the Curse of the Peladon. We do have the Ice Warriors as well. But this is, in terms of this situation, this is one of our nice little cans. We've got the storylines going on here of the, obviously, dealing with the Ice Warriors themselves, their discovery and figuring out what their intent is. A little bit of, do we trust you enough to help you get out of here, or are you too much of a threat and can't allow you to survive? And if we can't destroy you because our only means of destroying you could potentially destroy us, it's a really nice catch 22 all wrapped up in that one around this ionization beam that the base is using. But then you got the whole other side of it, which is this whole battle with technology. You know, you see these scavengers who have been just barely kind of getting by on the outskirts of this glacier, you know, dealing with the rigors of nature itself, which has turned against humanity. And then you've got the ultra dependence on computer command.
Yeah, except it's not exactly like we've seen before a lot with people subservient to computers. The computer isn't autonomously making these decisions. They submit their decisions to the computer for approval or denial, which is a little bit different than what you see other times.
Yeah. I mean, it really comes to its fever pitch, obviously, within the last couple of minutes of the final episode when they're trying to decide, you know, how they're going to be able to handle it. They've got a potential outcome that they could pursue, but it means going against all the instructions that the computer has been feeding over to them. And Penley's ready to pull the switch. And you see what Clint and Garrett, they're like rending their clothing and gnashing their teeth because it's almost a religious thing. It's like an affront to a god. The way that they treat it. But as you said, it's not as if the computer is mandating these things. It's simply spitting the information forward. They've become so dependent on the accuracy of that data to make all of their decisions.
They don't trust their own ability to make decisions anymore.
Nor do they even possess them, really. Well, it's funny. I guess you get a little bit from Garrett because she takes it upon herself to go out and try and seek Penley and those things. You know, she has those moments where she tries to make the appeal to bring this great mind back to the scientists and so forth. And that's obviously not something that she felt it prudent to consult the computer for and such. But I don't know. But Clint is gone. Absolutely gone. Mm. I don't know. What was your take on as far as like the statement that was being made about those individuals who decided to break away from the base? And, you know, you've got your man of science, or you've got your man of science and rationality and control, and then you've got the adventurers. We see a hint of it right in the beginning with Arden and all of his guys out there, the red shirt team out there.
Of course they got themselves killed. Those guys were idiots.
What could possibly go wrong? It looks like a Viking. But then as freewheeling as they seem to be, then you're dealing with Penley, who is adamant. And then you meet Penley's cohort there, played by Angus. A character keeps eluding me here.
Beardy guy number two.
Super beardy guy. Well, and they are completely off the deep end. Mm. They're at the point where the scavenger name suits extremely well. They are trying to be as off the grid as possible, but they're trapped in this frozen wasteland. I think as much as the statements that were being made about the reliance upon technology, or the sacrificing of core human reasoning and decision making skills to hand over to computer data and suggestion, that sort of thing, all absolutely critical to the storyline. But something that just kind of gets thrown out there because it's 1967, 68, is that they're talking about this return of an ice age, supposedly as a result of a nuclear winter. Mm. So, now granted, we're looking at things right now as far as people's discussions about, you know, the recurrence of global warming and climate change and those things, and are we going to be coming around the bend to another ice age after, you know, the greenhouse gases do something? We're going to block out the sun. We're going to that whole cyclical terrestrial pattern. But this is saying, essentially, hey, you guys are about 1,000 years away from it. So I found that struck me right off the top that was just an interesting kind of statement that was pretty timely, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Or sooner, maybe. But
yeah. Well, granted, but they were obviously looking at it under the guise of the threat of nuclear war, which is very, very poignant for their period. I don't know. I guess This is one of the cases where the heavy reliance upon technical jargon and scientific, you know, pseudoscientific explanations they were giving about the ionizer and the, and, you know, what type of engines are they using? Is it a mercury-based drive and so forth? You give all that a pass, I think, because of the fact that the problems within the plot lines, and I don't mean problems with the plot lines, I mean problems that they were dealing with in the plot lines, were so complex and layered, and one dependent upon another, that they, you really didn't, that I didn't particularly dwell on the pseudoscience at all.
Well, and typically when I'm watching shows from this era, I don't worry too much about the techno babble because I know that's what it is. And it's not going to hold up to, you know, a modern scrutiny on real science because we have information they didn't have then. And especially for a TV show they were writing that wasn't, you know, specifically seeking to teach kids about this part of science, they weren't going to take the effort to check that. So I give that a pass.
Right. Well, even down to they were going on like the doctor's explanation of what the atmospheric makeup of Mars versus Earth was, you know, based on their understanding at the time. And granted, we know now that the things like the nitrogen levels and those things weren't accurate to what they were to what they were speaking of. But it helped propel. I mean, if you were to take that as truth for the time, then, you know, his strategy was sound. Interesting that it also doubles as smelling salts. So, hey, I don't know. I just, and you're now a couple of stories in to Troughton.
Yes.
To be able to really get a feel for that now. So what's your take as far as, I mean, we're only going over the span of a couple of years here, but I personally see leaps and bounds of changes, inherent changes to the nature of the of Classic Who at this point as we get into Troughton's you know, sophomore year or sophomore season and things. What are you noticing about just the way the stories flow?
I don't know if it's a story flow thing, but in general, it seems like they're a little more sweeping. Like, it seems like it feels less like a soundstage sometimes, if you know what I'm saying, or they're using their soundstages differently to make it seem like this story is taking place over a larger area. You know, we were out on the ice, we were in whatever area the scavengers were in, we were in the base, we were at the ship, several different sets, and they felt like they didn't feel like they were butted right up against each other like happens sometimes in some of the older stories.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I guess I'd have to look and see whether they will be able to work on a slightly larger soundstage for some of the principal indoor shoots. I know they tried to do a lot of location things, like even like the footage of the bear was not stock footage. They ended up actually going out and seeking the footage for realism and so forth. But when you get things like, you know, when Victoria was on the run through the glacier, through the various corridors and crevasses through the glacier and things, and they would take like the long shots, you'd be able to see way down a corridor when our friend Angus, who, you know, finds her and you know, she's got her arm trapped. I think it's like the fourth or fifth episode where she's, you know, she's trapped in the grip of the dead ice warrior, and Storr, that's his name, finds him. You know, she's way back on the set, you know, and he was able to do that kind of distance run to her until they cut to a long side, to another camera location. And it just, as you said, it kind of fills out that fuller nature of it.
Right. I think they were it's probably not more space, just they figured out how to use that space to make it seem bigger.
Right. Yeah. Or maybe I don't know if they were trying to break away from a lot of the fixed camera locations instead of just doing that kind of focal point shoot that they would normally do. They had some unusual shots. Higher elevations too. A lot of times they were able to do a lot of things where you could take in, well, I didn't really understand like the chandeliers in the middle of the computer control room and those things, and you know, when things start shaking up. But they paid a lot of attention to things like, you know, when there were avalanche collapses and things of that sort. Things were falling from considerable heights so that you didn't see, you know, the boom mics and the lighting rigs and stuff, you know, casting shadows across the guys who were shaking the buckets of ice down and such.
Right.
So that was all making steady improvements too. This one in particular, though, I think the only thing that kind of struck me is maybe not ideal was I think it was a bit of a step backward on some of the incidental sound. Necessarily sound fully, but some of the music that they chose to put in, it didn't quite suit, but it's minor, you know. I usually notice it more when the sound is, or when the music, the score is really exceptional and it drives it forward. That catches my ear more often, but I guess I had actually, since I had been doing the rewatch around the house, and we had a couple of people passing through and things, and they were saying, "Oh, I remember the Ice Warriors. Yeah, they did that thing with the submarine episode." And yeah, well, here's the origin point. Here's where it all began from. And the questions were things like, "Why the hell do they whisper?"
Constantly? They're speaking Parseltongue, and the TARDIS is translating it for us.
Apparently, when they were doing a lot of all of the Ice Warriors dialogue was done in post-production voiceovers, because they wanted the guys in the suits to actually have the lips latex mounted to their faces so they could have more accurate lip movement. I mean, as accurate as it was, considering it could have been a lot worse. But that way, I guess in order to do so, it really restricted their ability to speak. So they were speaking the lines for timing, and they'd end up having to do it over again. But it's why every once in a while, as you'd have one of the discussions, like maybe between, Varga and Zondal or something like that, you'd hear a microphone pop because they were just, doing, the quick voiceover work straight into the mic. So that, I guess they were trying to, there was that cognizant effort to try and match the quality of the visual to the quality of the audio. I think it served really well for the animated reconstructions because the audio was so clean that, granted, some folks aren't really keen on the animation. Alyssa from Whovian Feminism was actually doing a rewatch of this a little earlier this week, and she was saying things like, "Oh God, please get me back to the live action episodes."
Yeah.
Because it was like a really rough Archer.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever watched it, but like some of the College Humor animated videos they did, that kind of flash animation is what it looks like.
Yeah, and that's about the era, too. I mean, that's the point where they're really starting to get it down. And granted, now, flash animation, or as far as that's advanced, we're now looking at, I use Archer as a yardstick, because if you go back and you watch some of the early episodes of that.
Season one had
that kind of a feel. But they evolved their technology to go along with it, granted with an FX budget. So, we attacked this when we were watching 10th Planet, too, and it's a matter of, is it beneficial to do more of these animated recreations?
As somebody who's watched some of the Loose Cannon reconstructions, the animations are light years better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just because it's so easy to tell what the action is going on. And which leads me to a question. How do they know what this action is? Like, do they have the scripts and that's what they're going on? Is the stage direction from that? Or is it people remember what happened in the episode?
Stage direction and calling. Well, it's a combination of things. So you've got stage direction and calling cues from the scripts themselves. You've got, obviously, recollection from existing staff and talent that will be able to say, when we were shooting this one, it was a close-up on so-and-so. So there may be some contribution from that as well, as best as can be remembered. There is some surviving footage because obviously some of the segments that were edit points still exist. They use them in some of the Loose Cannon as much as they could. And you would try to base where they were doing, because you saw, even in this particular case, even though there were more camera locations, a lot of them were, when we come back to the control room, you got a camera here and a camera here based on whether or not they're focusing over on Garrett when she's at the control panel, or if they're focusing on, Clint when he's pontificating and roaming around the room. So if that's the case, then they can say, all right, well, anytime we're going to go back to one of those scenes, we're going to use, these kind of points. And then obviously from the telesnaps, since they knew they'd be able to line up shots appropriately for certain ones and say, all right, at this point in the conversation, they were zooming in close on Arden or something like that, because that's the one of the captures that they were able to get off the monitor screen. So I get, and to a certain degree, creative license, I would imagine.
Just doing their best to tell the story as they know it occurred.
Yeah. But you notice that none of them ever really try to go overboard. It's not as if they're trying to invent some camera conveyance or something like that that just doesn't seem natural to classic Who at the time. It's not like they're trying to pull effects or anything like that wouldn't have been in the original. So I think
sweeping vistas or anything like that.
the most they're going to do is they're just going to clean up the credits a little bit because they were a little fuzzy.
Yeah.
Or eliminate camera shake. or they were kind to a couple of actors' faces.
So,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to move on to a different question.
Well, I was just, and I was, because my head was just going to this, because it was funny, I think it was the third episode is the first one where they get Jamie into the plastic outdoor suit. Right. And I'm wondering to myself as I'm watching this, I'm like, you know, I didn't really want to go back and look at the loose cannon again, but I got to wonder, how the hell did they pack the kilt into a two-legged set of plastic pants? Because it still ran all the way down to his knees in the animation.
I would think he put the kilt on over it.
One would think that that would be the practical thing to do. Although that plastic right against the skin.
Well, I mean, I guess I was assuming he had on underwear of some sort.
He's a Highlander.
Yeah, but he's been traveling on the TARDIS. The doctor's like, hey, we got these snazzy new things called underwear.
Boxers.
Or briefs, whatever you're into.
Sure, yeah. I don't know. We'll have to ask Fraser about how he dealt with the boxer.
Or maybe the clear suit has like those little underwear mesh kind of underwear.
Yeah,
like swim
trunks. Yeah. Sure. The things you wonder about during the quieter scenes.
So my next question was, how did they go about choosing which stories they were going to do these animated reconstructions for?
Well, I would imagine to a certain degree, well, obviously at the end of the day, it's got to come down to business, is whether or not that they can, you know, if it's a matter of A, is it only a handful of episodes?
So it's a mostly complete story and you just need to make a couple pieces.
Yep. And then B, is doing so and getting that now completed story out to market viable for the disc production or tape production or whatever was being done at the time. You know, we were talking about this last time as to whether or not, you know, now that we're going with digital distribution at that point, does it now mean that the BBC can look at it and say, all right, well, we don't have to worry about production runs necessarily, or, you know, that's not our primary concern because our initial market is going to be direct to download. So does that mean that we can go back? And probably I would imagine now that for some of these houses, if that's the nature of the animation, if they're not looking to gussy it up any more than what they've been doing, that today is pretty quick, cheap turnaround.
Yeah. Well, and I was wondering if there have been talk about the BBC launching their own sort of streaming service of some sort. I was thinking, you know, what if they just made it part of their business plan with that every month they're going to release some new animated reconstructions of classic Who episodes. So that keeps people subscribed to your service to get this new content that they haven't been able to see before.
Right, right. There were a couple of guys that that I had heard, I forget what convention I was at, but we were doing a Lost Episodes panel, and they had some interesting insight on some of the legal ramifications of the reconstructions and the animated revisits. So I might have to reach out to them and see if there's any kind of insight on that. Plus, we also have a contact or two that we had run into at the last, was it LI Who 3 that we ended up chatting with a couple of the guys from the reconstruction or the restoration team, I think. So we'll have to see what they know too. Maybe they've got some insight on it as well, because that's, to me personally, since I know that there are, at least within the Troughton era, there are still a handful of more stories where we've got at least half of the surviving episodes. So they could potentially fall into that bucket. I'd like to see them back. Or at least scenes from, you know, if they get the BBC's blessing to be able to say, you know what, we're just going to take this one great scene because it's a great exchange between this doctor and this very seldom seen companion and so forth. Or it's just it's a critical moment for the history of the canon and so forth. And so we wanted to just do this as you said, like a webisode that once every couple of months or so, they put one of these gifts out there. And it's not even the entire episode. But if it gets interest peaked and based on, you know, fan response to that, they could say, all right, well, maybe we'll go back and revisit this in full. Mm-hmm. The last kind of point about this particular story, I guess, was the the way that it kind of wraps up, knowing where we go forward and the fact that we are going to be, you know, encountering the Ice Warriors again, but it seems like the, you know, we talk about the Doctor not being willing to really see any species to its destruction, you know, unless there's absolutely no other choice. In this particular case, since the Doctor really hasn't encountered these Ice Warriors before, at least as far as he ever lets on, it's not as if he has any kind of breadth of knowledge of them previously, that as far as he may know, these are the only survivors, and yet he's willing to kind of see them to their potential demise, getting essentially melted out of the sky, or out of the, you know, off the face of the earth. Did that register with you at all? I kind of caught that in the final moments where he was just really kind of passive about it, mm-hmm. and let Penley go about his business.
Well, it's something I've noticed in the, like, I haven't seen as much classic Who as you have, but it seems mm-hmm. like up to this point, the Doctor takes a more human-centric, Earth-centric view of the universe. So when it comes down to humans versus some other race, especially a race that's not humanoid or mm-hmm. looks very different from us, he sides with the humans, and he's okay with them doing what it takes to ensure their own survival.
Right, right.
Okay. In a way that we probably wouldn't see as much with the modern Doctors.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's understandable. I guess you'd have to kind of watch them be with that frame of mind, or with that awareness, kind of watching to see where the change occurs, where the character starts to take on or recover a more... I'm actually going to say this, a more extraterrestrial view of things, and isn't quite so Earth-centric. Because I think perhaps, I know that you don't get much of it within the Pertwee era, obviously, because that's his exile period for the longest time. So for a while, it is just he and Joe, or he and, you know, and it's, and everything is still latched on to the advancement and the protection of the human race. But yeah, by the time we get to Baker, not only is that scale widened, but also it seems like he, you know, how each regeneration tends to pull out different elements of the persona, but by the same mm-hmm. token, it also either brings forward or checks back his fuller knowledge of his travels and his history. You know, you have at times the Doctor doesn't remember everything that he's done and all the places he's been, and other times he's right on point and he can remember everything from across his 800 or 1200 or 1600 years of history.
Right.
That may be something that you could chalk a lot of this up to as well. By the time you get to Fourth Doctor, you know, the blinder's completely off and he's so in tune with everything that it's almost laughable to him for the people that don't. So, all right. Well, I know we'll be revisiting more of our classic rewatches in 2 episodes hence, because we always kind of skip around a little bit. But we've definitely still have a lot of Troughton to enjoy. I personally love this period. This is obviously, you know, his travels with Jamie. You know, we haven't quite gotten around to Zoe and so forth when you really get that solid TARDIS team. But even kicking around with Victoria for all of her screaming, and I hate the fact
and that that's crying all. Thing that she did.
Well, I don't know. At times, it almost just seemed like take when she was on the when she was like running through the corridors, hiding, drop the communicator, pick up the communicator, that she was testing for Echo to see if she could cause an avalanche. You know,
she was like a tuning fork.
Yeah, there was one point where she turns around and she screams at really no real necessary time. And I got a feeling that she uses that as a weapon. That's just the way that I draw from it. But yeah, so we'll be coming back around to some more thoroughly enjoyable Patrick Troughton as well. Because we've got some great stuff coming up. Obviously, right after Ice Warriors, you're dealing with Enemy of the World, Web of Fear, and Fury from the Deep, which are just 3 amazing stories. Whether you get to see them, hear them, or read them, they are the core of where a lot of the great stuff from the Troughton era come about. And even going on from there, like, you know, Wheel in Space, The Mind Robber, Invasion, Seas of Death, just this is all gold. So we're in for a great ride. But in the interim, you feel like doing some news or something?
We could do some news.
All right. All right, so I think personally, Fadi El-Sayed is messing with us. That's just me.
I buy it.
you could be your own judge. Apparently, just a little bit earlier today, as we're recording this, there was a tweet from Fadi, who is obviously, as we've discussed, one of the cast members for the spinoff series Class, which we'll be soon seeing. I think. They are in furious in production right now, and I'm sure we'll start getting some teaser trailers and sizzle reels and things like that before too long. Well, he tweets a picture today, you know, speaking in emojis as these crazy kids do these days, of him standing behind a weeping angel somewhere on the set or in a prop room or something. I think it's a prop room because there's like storage cages and stuff behind him. So the question becomes, is he just messing around with the props and, you know, I'm taking a selfie with a weeping angel, in which case he's actually infecting all of us because we're looking into the, into the photo and therefore taking on, or does this mean that we're actually going to have an established villain in class at some point?
Well, I think you're right. Based on this picture, it does look like it's probably somewhere in the prop department. That backdrop does not look like something you would see in a school. But
no,
I think the angels are an interesting villain to put in a school where it's mostly kids and something they could just scare the crap out of.
Yeah, that would be the next logical thing to do with weeping angels is selfies and smartphone, you know, immediate video capture and the eyes always on you kind of thing.
And, I mean, imagine like in a school with the lights off, running up and down the hallways with angels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It'd be like a classic horror film.
Yes. Yes. It'd be a kind of a, I know what you did last semester kind of a thing. Yeah. Share your thoughts on it. You know, it's really just kind of a yay or nay kind of thing as to whether or not, Fadi's messing with us or whether he's giving us an unapproved hint into something that could be going on for the upcoming class season. So next thing we got on the roster here as far as, well, we love David Tennant. It's been established how much we adore David Tennant. I don't know if everyone out there in listening land happens to be a fan of the Family Guy series or whether you just let it be what it is. But apparently Tennant has lent not only his voice, but his 10th Doctor character to a quick little moment.
I didn't know they were still making new episodes of Family Guy.
Yeah, so that says quite a bit. Well, you know, as we mentioned early on here, this is SDCC week here in the States, San Diego Comic-Con, and it's usually the convention where the majority of the industry-related attention-grabbing material gets released. This is where big trailers drop. This is where casting announcements get made. This is where the industry really tries to sell. So Fox Animation has stepped forward and said, oh, well, you know, for those of you who still know that Family Guy is on the air, we've got our season coming up. And they put together their, I don't know if this is a trailer or a teaser. I guess it's labeled as a sizzle reel, I guess, technically, because it runs at a little over a minute. So it's not an ad or anything of that sort. And it's got, you know, as typical Family Guy fare, it's some of the most offensive stuff that they can put together without actually crossing the line and getting into cable networks. But Tennant appears as his titular character, and apparently the name of the series, though, has been rewritten to Doctor Who Farted.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, and it's essentially just him stepping out of the TARDIS and warning anyone coming towards the TARDIS not to go in just yet. Just give it a few minutes for obvious reasons, you know, as he's fanning the door behind him and making up excuses. So that's pretty much the entire joke. So now you don't need
to. I'm sure the joke goes on for like a minute and a half.
Maybe, yeah. Thankfully, in this particular, the way this was edited, it's just quick cuts from offensive segment to offensive segment. If you're a Family Guy fan, rock out, enjoy it. It is Tennant, so you can at least enjoy that. And they didn't mess around with like trying to make the TARDIS look ridiculous or anything. They kept it all accurate. They didn't misspell anything on the police box or anything of that sort. Yeah, so take it for what it is. I'm sure the season will be absolutely fine. But moving on to some other interesting news about seasons that either are or aren't. Haley, I'm going to throw this entirely into your lap because I don't really know what to make of this. It's fool me once, fool me twice, fool me three times.
Okay, so let's just start by putting it out there. the title of the article, John Barrowman in talks to bring Torchwood back to TV. And it's on zaptoit.com, which is a reliable source for TV ratings. I don't know how reliable they are for news.
Mm.
But I would think publishing some random rumor they heard on the streets.
Right. No, well, this is, I think, as far as I understand, this is taken directly from his quote. So they were probably, because I've seen this same reference in a couple of other sources, Radio Times and a few other very credible sources. So he did actually have this discussion, you know, as he was speaking with Comic-Con headquarters. This is as of Friday the 22nd. And he said that, and this is his quote, that he's currently working hard to bring Torchwood back to TV. And he quotes, "I have a phone conversation on Monday," which would be, you know, today as we're recording this on the 25th, "to see how we can get this back on television."
Mm-hmm.
The fans know me well enough. I'm only going to say it if I mean it and believe it. Now, this is in Barrowman speak. A lot of this means that he means and believes that he is having a phone conversation to see how they'll get it back on television.
Okay. So the latest I remembered hearing specifically from him is that if he was asked to do it, he would do it, but he was currently under contract with the CW for the DC shows they're doing there. This is a little more active role than I've heard him mention taking in the project up to this point.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I guess the way that he's sort of seeing the momentum is that based on the successes of the audiobooks and audio plays that they have recently done, both for the BBC and for Big Finish, and the Titan comic series that is about to drop that has a lot of anticipation around it, and obviously just the continued Torchwood-related books that he and Carol continue to publish, and they do exceptionally well, that there is still an audience for it, and so it's still a viable franchise. So we'll see. I got a feeling, knowing him, that if things do get some sort of a green light, he's not going to be able to hold his tongue for very long. You know, we're in the middle of con season, and every time they put him on a panel, he kind of, you know, once he, you know, he gets up to full speed, it's tough to hold him back. So he may blurt something. Who knows?
He will.
He will blurt something. Positively or negatively. So we'll know one way or the other, I'm sure, within a couple of conventions from here. Last little piece just to include in here, because it's kind of awesome. The production crew, as they're putting together Series 10, have now said, okay, next production block, we need to go off to location. We're going to Spain. So despite the fact that Brexit is going to make their travel a little more difficult over the months and years ahead, they are off to Spain. So Pearl Mackey and PCAP and company have all arrived in Valencia. So they were doing some shooting at the City of Arts and Science Museum, which, as you'll see from some of the photos that have been put out there, is a gorgeous facility. You got to wonder what they're going to be doing with it. It has a very otherworldly feel to it. The architecture is huge and open and expansive and bright and very futuristic. So you could do a ton of things with it. But they were shooting selfies because it's Pearl Mackey. And looking like they thoroughly enjoy themselves. A lot of people were commenting on the fact that Capaldi, who rarely like puts on the big goofy grin, was putting on the big goofy grin, you know. And wherever they are within their production cycle, as far as these episodes where they're supposed to be fitting in within the lay of the season, his hair is still enormous and formidable and awesome. But he has
no buzz cut this season.
No buzz cut. No, I don't think his hair has returned to that degree of shortness since the first six episodes. And at that point, he said, "Nah, I'm off this. Let it grow." Let it grow.
He likes to run his fingers through it.
It just adds to the insanity. But So I'm sure we're gonna continue to get some more information about what's been shot there, because that's not a location that you go to and you're just done within 2 days and clear out. So I'm sure we'll get some more over the next couple of days too. So keep your ears tuned for that, and your eyes peeled as well, because apparently they're letting her share. I'm not going to say carte blanche, but she's being given a lot of freedom, as we're seeing with the class crew too. they're being a lot more open about, you know, behind the scenes and on set social shares, which is great. I like the approachability. So all in all, as I said, we'll be reconvening for the next episode to step back from the classic rewatches for a little while. We're going to delve into something a little challenging, I guess. We've been talking a lot about how the potential under Chris Chibnall's direction and showrunning leadership in Series 11 is going to involve a writer's room. We already know some of the return names for writers that are coming into Series 10. But we wanted to look at some of the patterns and things that have been established with writers that we've been hearing from on a regular basis, people that are getting added to the regular rotation. Sort of a look at these recurrent writers' styles and techniques, whether it be Paul Cornell, Jamie Matheson, Sarah Dollard, who we're going to be getting more from for next season, and just what their particular styles contribute to what that means for an episode, either under a particular doctor or just for the show in general. It's going to be an interesting challenge, I think, for each of us on the GPR side, but just in looking at really identifying traits of these writers in general. You know, can you identify an episode as saying, well, other than a Mark Gatiss episode, sorry, Jay, of what qualifies as a, you know, a Jamie Matheson episode or something of that sort, or a Phil Ford episode, what have you. Yeah. And we will be incorporating some classic Who, because we've got a lot of writers like Kit Pedler and those things. You've got recurrent writers that we want to look and see what they've done historically too. So definitely something to enjoy. If you have particular writers that you are fond of, either classic or new Who, because of something that they particularly bring to the table or something that they often incorporate into their stories that you favor and you want to share that with us, by all means, please tweet, post, comment, email us, leave a voicemail, just, you know, and share those things with us too, so we can incorporate them into the discussion for next week. But there's that.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'm ready to start closing this out here.
I think so.
Okay. Well, this has been episode 193 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Kira saying, Jay, though you're not with us in the studio, you are the most insufferably irritating an infuriating person I have ever been privileged to work with.
And this is Haley saying, your regulations do not apply to me. I work in my own way, freely.
Yeah, she's really lined up for that new gig. I'm sure the new employers are digging her just fine. Yep. We'll see everybody next week.
Bye.
Allison.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.
I gotta wonder sometimes. We just need to tell. All right, we're testing out a new alien. You know, you're gonna be the guy in the suit here. Just when you're not speaking, stand still. Don't pull focus on camera, because you know it's hard enough for us to tell when one of you guys is talking. So if it's not your line, stand stock still so the other guy can be a little animated and say, ah, blah, 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 blah. But they're all wiggling the whole time, all four of them on screen. I love the final moment where they're getting blasted by the ionizer and they're all on camera, all waving around and freaking out before the eedly-oop waves kick in. That needs to be a looping gif over and over and over, like the Cybermen rave party gift that you see out there. I just want to see them freaking out on camera. I love the Ice Warriors.
Yep.
I hope we're not done with them. I really hope we're not done with them. I still don't have an answer as to why they whisper like that, but
I think what it is they wanted them to sound alien, and they'd already used all the electronic filters they had at the BBC, so this was one way they could make them sound different that they hadn't done yet.
They hadn't even decided necessarily. I guess from some of the original designs, when they were trying to come up with, I think the producer, produces one, Innes, I think. I can't remember. Who said, you know, was describing what they wanted for this alien species, but there was nothing being said about making them reptilian. It was the costume designer who ran off with that thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how that ended up impacting what they chose to do. I mean, he was describing, initially they were describing something that was just inherently Martian. You know, it was going to have some sort of a weird respiratory system because of the different, you know, atmospheric makeup and so forth. But, and they were just going to be kind of bug-eyed natured aliens. But I guess when they said that they had to be wearing armor that had technological advancements, somehow that evolved into an exoskeleton, and you end up with this weird scaly.
Maybe somebody was thinking, well, Mars is kind of like a desert, so maybe they're like a desert lizard kind of thing.
I don't know. I mean, the die had been cast at that point. They weren't going to, you know, we made four of these suits.
So
we blew the budget.